recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Infamous Indie. This week, a very, very special and interesting interview. I really am going to apologize first and foremost for the audio quality. I've been messing with my equipment over the last few weeks, and I've finally been able to kind of get it to a point where I have a good understanding and a way to interview people without it sounding really echoey, but unfortunately, this interview isn't that case. This interview was done in my house in one of my rooms, and you'll be able to hear it and understand it. But it, you know, I apologize for the quality of this interview. I'm working again to make it a lot better for you from now on. With that said, and this week the interview is with Misty Wallace. Misty is an Indianapolis native, and this story started back in 1992 when she was shot at a Burger King in Indianapolis. And that's as far as I'm going to tell you. That's all you really need to know for this podcast. She does a great job telling her story. She does it all the time. And you're just going to really enjoy it. Honestly, that's all you're going to have to really know for this one. And I hope you enjoy it. Please give me some feedback on this one, because Misty is a powerful, powerful person and spirit. And I just want to share that. And I think you all should be excited to hear from her. So take a deep breath. Hold on tight and listen in, because this one's going to rock your world. It's great. Please enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to the interview portion of the Infamous Indie Podcast. Across from me is Misty Wallace, but I didn't want to give you too many details, because I think this interview, you'll learn exactly what happened to Misty and why we're doing this podcast and why we're doing this interview. And you're really the reason why I want to do a podcast like this. I want to give people like you a voice, and your story is incredible. So why don't you just tell my listeners exactly what happened.
Okay. On October 18th, 1992. My journey, my life changed forever. I was a senior in high school. I had a full ride scholarship to play softball. Things were going great. I was out with some friends on October 18th, 1992, and my boyfriend and I were out haunted housing on the southwest side of Indianapolis. He and I had gotten into an argument that evening, and I went to drop him off at home. When he got out of the car, he slammed my car door, which kind of, at 18 years old, made me more angry. But as I drove away, I said something that I will never, ever, ever say again in my life. As I drove away angry, I had both hands on the steering wheel, and just out of anger, I said, I wish I was dead. And just out of anger. And honestly, I don't even know what we were even arguing about to this day. I drove up Kentucky Avenue, mad. I didn't want to go home. I pulled into a Burger King restaurant to make a phone call on a payphone. We didn't have cell phones back then. When I pulled into the Burger King restaurant, I pulled right next to the payphone, made a phone call home to mom and dad, and let them know that I was going over to my friend's house. As I'm on the payphone, I noticed that a car had pulled around through the back of the Burger King, through the Goodyear and the plaza area there at Marwood Plaza. The car pulled into the front parking spot at the Burger King restaurant. I noticed a gentleman had exited the passenger side of the vehicle. My mom and dad did not answer the phone. I had called and my boyfriend at the time and told him not to call home and wake my mom and dad up, that I was going over to a friend's house. During my phone conversation with him, the guy that got out of the passenger side of the vehicle walked towards the back end of my car. I looked at him. He said, "How long are you going to be?" And I said, "Just a few minutes." My boyfriend said, "Who's that?" I said, "Someone wants to use the payphone." And he said, "Okay, well, just call me later." As soon as I hung up the payphone, he pulled a gun, stuck it to my head, my left cheek, pulled the trigger. The bullet went through my left cheek, down through my esophagus, severed the tip of my carotid artery, and it bounced up through the back of my esophagus and broke the back two vertebrae in my neck. And that's where the bullet lodged. My body automatically went into shock. I landed underneath the front tire of my vehicle. And as I'm laying on the ground, trying to grasp everything that had to happen, my ears were ringing really, really bad. A lot of blood. And all I could think about was, I noticed that he had gone around the back of my vehicle and gotten into the driver's seat of my car. And the whole time, all I could think about was, please God, don't let this car start. A few seconds later, he exited the vehicle. He walked away. As he walked away, I said, please help me. But he left me there to die. He walked away. A gentleman that was working a shift at Rolls Royce that evening got called in to run a test on some jet engines that the military was using during Saudi Arabia. And they had brought some sand over to make sure our jets can land in the sand over there, and he had to run this test. Saturday night, got called in. He went in, ran the test. He left work. He always turns right out of Rolls Royce to go home, to get on 70 and take it home. This night, he turned left and came up Kentucky Avenue. He had to have passed just as soon as it happened. As soon as the shooter left the scene, he had to be passing because he could see. He said it was weird that he was driving up Kentucky Avenue and all he could see was my body laying on the ground.
So your car was still there?
My car was still there, yeah. Yeah, at that time, my car was still there. A few seconds later, he had pulled around to the front of my vehicle and shined the lights on my car, and thought it was kind of odd that I was laying on the ground. And once he came up on me, he could tell. At that point, I had gotten my body turned over onto my back, which was not a good idea. At that point, he had to roll me over on my side. Mm. I was choking to death in my own blood. I was gurgling and choking on my own blood. He rolled me over on my side. He said, I'll be right back. I need to get something out of my trunk. I called 911. I'm going to stay right here by your side until they get here. He was a EMT. He was American Red Cross trained and everything, Vietnam vet, pastor in church. And he stayed right by my side the whole time. And the paramedics got there, they cut my clothes off, they put me in a shock suit. My body was in bad shape at that point.
A shock suit?
A shock suit.
What's a shock suit?
It's a big white diaper thing. That's all I remember. It was a big, it felt like a big white plastic diaper. They started IVs in the back of the ambulance. I know my ambulance ride to Eskenazi, which was Wishard then.
You're remembering all of this at this point?
I remember all of it, yes. Yeah. The ambulance ride was really chaotic. There was a lot of movement, people working on me. It was getting harder for me to breathe. Got to the hospital. They took me into Wishard and started running all kinds of tests. The bullet never exited my body, so they were trying to find out where it was located. Into special tests, they found out the bullet was lodged in between the back of my neck muscle, and it had broken the top two vertebrae in my neck. So those fragments from those bones are now in my spinal fluid. And they told my mom and dad that if I lived through surgery, that I would not walk again, because of those fragments would have me paralyzed from my waist down. After all the testing was ran, they knew they were waiting on vascular surgeons, ear, nose, and throat surgeons. Many surgeons later, many hours later, right before I went into surgery. I think this was probably the hardest part out of all this was I knew something bad was wrong, but I didn't know how bad until they took me in a room. When I was in this little room, it was real bright, and this detective came in and started asking me yes and no questions so I could squeeze his hand, because it was I couldn't talk anymore. I opened my eyes, and my whole family was standing there, my mom, my dad, my brothers, my sister, my grandparents who were alive at the time. They're all standing there over me saying goodbye. And that was probably the hardest part through everything, was I couldn't even tell them goodbye. I couldn't say goodbye to them. They were screaming, they were yelling, they were hollering, they were crying. It was very chaotic. They took me in immediately because my carotid artery was severed, and they had already put a drain tube in my head to drain the fluid off the back of my skull. I went into surgery. I woke up the next day. I was on life support. I was on a ventilator. I stayed on life support for 3 days in ICU. Started to wake up. They started weaning me off the ventilator. Didn't go so well the first time because I kind of started pulling my own tubes out and stuff, so they put me back to sleep very quickly. And they brought my dad in the room when they weaned me off later on that evening. Once they weaned me off life support, I started breathing on my own, started healing, was doing better. Day four later that evening, I went into a regular room at the hospital. I got out of ICU, started healing, started having more visitors. Day seven, I left the hospital and went home and started recovering. I had a long road ahead of me. I had to learn how to speak. I had to learn how to move my facial muscles. I had to learn how to eat and chew again. I went through tons of therapy, a lot of physical therapy, mental therapy.
What? This is insane.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that you walked into my house today.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
Yes. Yep. It's all a miracle. I went 1 month. I'd been home healing. I was home. I was crazy. I needed to get out of the house. I played Yahtzee with everybody that came in my house. I needed to get out. I needed some fresh air. So my dad came in from a trip. He was a truck driver. And when he came in, I talked to him, and my grandfather was ill. And he decided that we could go visit him that evening just to get me out of the house for a little bit. And I had staples from the back of my ear all the way down to my throat. I had this big neck brace on. The bullet stayed in my neck for 2 years, so I lost my scholarship to play softball. With the bullet sticking out the back of my neck and this big neck brace on, we get in the car. And at that point, my car was back. We drove my car because the starter went out on my car that night at the Burger King. It had to be towed from the crime scene. My dad had to have a wrecker pick it up and take it in to put a new starter in it. I never had any problems with my car. we had gotten the car back from the shop, and Dad wanted to drive it, so we took it to visit my grandfather that night. And we came to the intersection of Vermont and Lyndhurst in Indianapolis. And what are the odds that that night, the very first night out, that I came face to face with the vehicle that pulled into the Burger King restaurant that night? Sitting at the stoplight at Vermont and Lyndhurst, I looked up and I told my dad, I said, "That's the car." And my dad said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I said, "The guy driving the car is the guy that shot me." And so we followed into a gas station. He pulled into a little gas station. He got out of his car. He went in and got a pop. Came back out, got back in his car, and drove away. I did write down his license plate number. I went back to my grandfather's house where I was initially going.
Was your dad with you, though? Yes. And he wasn't going to do anything more than just write down the license plate number.
I think he wanted to do more.
Uh-huh. That's what I'm...
But because I was in the car, he chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
In the shape that I was in.
Sure, sure.
But I'm pretty sure that it was... He wanted to do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And... but because of the shape that I was in, he wouldn't have done that with me in the car. I call my detective. He's out of town. He's in another state bringing someone back to Indiana for expediting him back on murder charges. So he got a hold of his friend detective, and they ran the license plate, and they went to the location. And his detective friend camped out there all night. By the time my detective got in the next morning, he went and knocked on the door, wanted to question the guy about a girl, a shooting at a payphone in his car. And the first thing he said was, "I didn't do it. It wasn't me. You got the wrong person." So they didn't believe his lies. They took him downtown to the Marin County courthouse. Or Marin County Jail, sorry. Took him downtown to Marin County Jail. Started asking questions. They had enough evidence to book him. He eventually pleaded not guilty, which led to a jury trial. 3 days, that jury trial went on for 3 days. Day three of the jury trial, they came back with a guilty verdict. A little after midnight the third day, they found him guilty of attempted murder, carrying a handgun in the state of Indiana without a license, and they threw out auto theft because he didn't get my car. And they threw out robbery because they never found my purse. So pretty much his charges were attempted murder and carrying a handgun in the state of Indiana without a license, and was sentenced to 20 years behind the wall at Pendleton Reformatory in Pendleton, Indiana.
And you were pretty satisfied then with the outcome?
Yes. Yeah. I would say. I mean, I'm still angry. I'm still mad. I'm still... Yeah. I had all those emotions. I wished he was dead. I mean, those are all normal human reactions, I believe. You know, someone to call so much pain upon someone, you want the same to happen to them. But he went behind the wall, serving a 20-year sentence. I went on with my life. I moved to California, got married, got out to California, about 2,000 miles away from home, and I started having post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Which is completely understandable. Yeah.
Which I had never dealt with in my entire life.
Sure,
so
sure.
I didn't know what I was dealing with. Mm. So I was finding myself in the ER 5 nights out of the week. I would go in full-blown panic attack mode, and they kept saying, "Everything's fine. You're healthy. There's nothing wrong with you." So they finally caught on and sent me to see a psychologist at the Naval Hospital in San Diego. Went to the Naval Hospital to have the evaluation, and boy, did they give me a list of diagnoses. I was post-traumatic stress syndrome, anxiety, depression, panic attacks, You name it, I had it. And there was a medication for every one of them. And all I did was sleep. I had no life. I was very depressed. I wanted to be with my family.
Back here in Indiana? Mm-hmm.
Back here in Indiana. Well, it did. That did happen. A very short time later, they ended up giving my husband at the time a honorable discharge from the United States military because of my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to Indiana, started a family, had my first child. 6 years later, had my second child. I went back to school, did some nursing, just living life. You know, he's in prison.
PTSD has gone down. You've been able to handle it, or
just been dealing with it. Mm-hmm. Medications on and off, preferably not the ones that make me sleep all the time. But
yeah, nobody wants to sleep all the time.
No, just living life. And man, I went to check the mailbox one day, and there was a letter from the Department of Corrections. It said my offender was being released. A whole new overwhelming amount of anxiety came over me. A whole new kind. A kind of, what has he been doing in prison the whole time? Is he going to finish me off because he didn't kill me the first time? I have two kids now. I'm scared to death. I always looked over my shoulder anyways. I always felt unsafe no matter where I went.
You're back in Indiana now, so yes. It's easier to find you.
Yes. And so I went on. I called downtown to the Department of Corrections. I said, what can I do? They said, there's nothing you can do. He served his time. 8 years and 8 months. And I was not happy with that, so I called them enough that they, a lady reached out to me, and she said, you know, you can file for a restraining order, that's all you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, but it doesn't usually go through because he's been incarcerated for 8 years and 8 months, so you can try. I did get a court date. I went downtown, Marion County building, on my court date. I was down in the basement area for this restraining order. As I was downstairs in the basement, my youngest brother went with me that day. Down in the basement, I was sick. I was in and out of the bathroom vomiting. My nerves were shot. I felt horrible. My youngest brother was with me that day. And he walked up to me after I came out of the bathroom. He said, hey, I'm going to get a candy bar out of the candy machine. We're getting ready to go in here at 1, and these things take forever. He goes, I didn't eat lunch today. I said, go ahead. He said, you want anything? I said, no. And as soon as I lifted my head up off the wall, my offender was walking towards me, and he walked right up to me, and he asked me where the courtroom was. And I looked over at my brother at the snack machine, and his face was purple. He was so mad. And I pointed down the hallway, and he said, thanks, and walked on.
Mm-hmm.
I went over to my brother. I said, let's go. He goes, what do you mean? I was like, he doesn't even know who I am. He doesn't even know me. He doesn't know who I am. I'm ready to go. Let's go. He said, no, we're not going anywhere. I'm right here by your side. We're going to get through this together. You went through all this, and I'm not going to leave your side. We're going to get through this. Went into the courtroom. I was the last one to go that day.
Of course.
Yeah. I went up through the doors. I sat down at the table. My brother was right behind me. He told me, I'll be right here behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Get through this. You can
mm-hmm.
do it.
Mm-hmm.
The judge granted the restraining order for a short time. As I was getting ready to leave the courtroom, my offender said, Your Honor, can I say something to Mist? And as soon as he started to say my name, my brother jumped up from behind me. He started yelling and screaming, shut your mouth. Don't talk to my sister. There's nothing you can say that will ever make this right. Shut your mouth. Well, then security started coming out everywhere. They took him off to a room, and my brother and I left the courthouse. But as a victim, all I can think about from that day forward was he really going to tell me he was sorry for shooting me in the head? I left the courtroom that day, and that stayed in the back of my head for a very long time. And I wasn't accepting it. I wasn't accepting it. I was angry. I was mad. I'm still very angry, still very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Still full of a lot of hate towards him. I had gone through a divorce. Went through a divorce. Now I'm a single mom, living on my own with two kids. Got my first apartment here in Indianapolis, living life. And then working two and three jobs. I get called into work one night. My niece came over to watch my kids. Typical, trusted her, no issues. She brought one of her friends with her, which was not abnormal. Went to work, came home, gave her a kiss, said, "Love you, Aunt Misty," gave her some money. She left. The next Monday, I went to work, came home to an empty house. Her friend had drug issues and robbed me blind. Took everything that I did have left, was gone. All gone. All my kids' stuff, everything. That's when I finally hit rock bottom. I was done. I couldn't take no more. I broke. I went in the kitchen. I got a knife. I called my ex-husband. I said, "Come and get the kids. I don't feel good." He came and got the kids. As I went to shut the door when they were leaving, he said, "Are you sure you're okay?" And I said, "I'm fine," because he knew I never gave the kids up on my weekends. And he said, "Are you sure you're okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine. I just don't feel good." Got the knife, sat in the kitchen floor. I made one more phone call. Called the same guy that pulled into the Burger King restaurant that night. His name's Tim Williams. And I told him, I was like, "I can't do it no more. Can't take it." I was at my lowest of the lowest I've ever been in my entire life. And he came and he sat on the floor with me for several hours. And I pulled myself back together. I knew that I had to for my kids.
This guy, Tim, man.
He's my angel.
I'd say
by far. He's an awesome, awesome man.
It's not all roses either.
No.
After this.
No.
Pulling it together.
No. No, it was not easy at all. It's like I started all over again. But I did it. And as I'm doing things and making better choices and getting help, I stay constantly either in church support groups, one-on-one counseling, and just, I was going through so much. I had so much anger, so much hate for everything that everybody kept doing to me. And I had started going to church. Tim Williams baptized me in his church himself.
Which church was that?
It's Mount Gilead out in Mooresville, Indiana.
Mount Gilead, sure.
And he baptized me in his church. And we started going to Mount Gilead. At that time, there was so many forgiveness things, and it was making me mad, actually. I wasn't, not happening. No, it made me more mad that it's like it kept slapping me in the face. And I struggled with it because I didn't understand it. But my way of understanding the forgiveness aspect, and I understand that we all have to forgive, my way of understanding it was I had to learn how to do it that best fit me. And the best way for me to do that was, I actually had someone say something to me that just really made me mad. And then it like triggered this whole effect of forgivenessness. They said, you need to, Misty, you need to forget about it and move on. That did nothing but make me mad.
Yeah, it's like telling someone, calm down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And move on. Forget about it, move on. But no, but when they said that to me, it triggered, how do I do that? But do it the right way. So I started working on forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled.
Mm-hmm.
Struggled. It was hard.
I'm sure.
But my way of understanding was that I could forgive someone. I could forgive him for doing that to me. But I learned through the process that I did not have to forget what happened to me. But it was how I chose to handle it as my own individual self. And so that was my way of... I always tell people I was mentally incarcerated for 17 and a half years. He was physically incarcerated for 8 years and 8 months. So my forgiveness, I had to be real. I had to be faithful and honest with myself. I took it a step further. And I sent him a message on Facebook. And I just simply said to him, I know you know who I am. I am no longer angry. I am no longer mad. I have chosen to forgive you. But I do have some questions.
Mm-hmm.
So at this time, I'll introduce my shooter who's with us today. Chaplain Keith Blackburn.
Sir Chaplain Keith Blackburn.
Yes.
You heard everything we just talked about.
Yes.
Well, what do you have? What's the first thing you have to say, I guess?
What kind of monster? What kind of monster would go into a parking lot and shoot an innocent woman in the head and leave her to die? What kind of parents did such a monster have? What kind of society or community did he grow up in? I grew up here, west side of Indianapolis, inner city neighborhood. Had a mom and dad at home that loved me very much. I often say I didn't come from a broken home. I came from a home that was just broke. And at 13 years old, I decided I wanted things that I couldn't afford to buy. So at 13, I rebelled against my home upbringing. I rebelled against God, rebelled against my mom, dad, and went to the streets hustling. I started stealing, started out bicycles, maybe steal some gold chains from the mall, go to school, sell them, steal some hood ornaments, you know, from Cadillacs, Mercedes, take them to school and sell them to the other kids, and breaking into cars, stealing radios, just anything we could do to make money. That continued. 14, I got involved with the little neighborhood gangs that we was formulating. It was just neighborhood things. 15 became more violent, began cutting school, started carrying a gun.
Were you acting out violently at that time?
Yes, started carrying a gun at that time, and a lot of gang fights, a lot of activities in the neighborhood. 16, started drinking. Found my drug of choice, which was LSD. Started getting more violent. Now we have cars. So now we're doing drive-bys similar to like on the movie Colors. And, you know, we was watching Scarface religiously, doing everything we thought we was tough enough to do. 16, I became real dark in my practices, dressed in all black. I was fascinated by Blood, Halloween movies, Michael Myers, Jason, Friday the 13th, fascinated by Jeffrey Dahmer, just did that. John Wayne Gacy, serial killers, doing research, read Helter Skelter, Charles Manson. I was just fascinated by the darkness and blood and crime, and just real dark in my practice. Took a cat out of the neighborhood. It was a black cat, you know, kind of represented that Hollywood, Satan, devil, black cat's evil. So I took this cat down to the park. I slit its throat, cut myself, mixed my blood with the cat's blood, made some kind of TV satanic ritual, promised I was going to serve the devil for the rest of my life. And 17 years old, I remember being 17, kind of like you remember a dream when you go to sleep, you wake up, you try to piece things together. I remember 17 more so from stories that people told me of what I'd done. It was more drinking, more acid, more drugs, and just dark. About September, I blew my knee out real bad. I had a real bad knee injury. So it took me kind of out of commission from doing a lot of crime. I was still drinking, still doing things. And I found if I was waiting knee surgery, I couldn't run. But if I was taking the pain medications, tripping on acid and drinking, I could walk and it didn't really cause that much pain because I was high. But I couldn't run. Well, on October 18th, 1992, was 1 week after I turned 18. Money was low, so we're going to go do this robbery. Plan was to go rob a store and get dropped off, go rob the little mom-and-pop store, and then run about a block and a half to get in my car and get away. I got dropped off at the store. As I was walking in the store to do the robbery, I had a sober thought. I can't run. So I'm not going to be able to get away from this robbery. So I bought a pack of Big Red gum, walked about a block and a half where my car was, and said, we need to go get a car so I can drive up to the store, get out, rob, and then we'll go spend the money. So we started looking for a car. We found one, you heard the story, at a Burger King. We pulled in. I got out to steal the car, and as I was approaching, I wanted to make sure the keys was in the ignition. They were, but as I was looking for the keys, I turned and the woman who was on the payphone, you heard her story. She had looked at me and it was a real intent look. And in my mind, at that moment, I said, I'm not going to leave anybody alive to be able to testify against me because I'm going to steal this car and I'm going to go do a robbery and we're going to go spend the money. So I pulled a gun and I put it to her head. I pulled the trigger. I did something you can never undo. Her body fell. I didn't know what you and your listeners know. I didn't know that her head had fell underneath the tire. I went into the car to steal it. I'm a car thief. So I get in the car. I tried to start it. I turned the key. It didn't do anything. No noise, no nothing, just dead, nothing. I didn't know what you and your listeners know, that she was underneath the wheel praying, God, please don't let this car start. I tried a second time. Nothing. It was a clutch. I checked the gears. Everything seemed to be in working.
Have you ever stole a car? Were at that point stolen a car before and it just didn't work?
Not to this. No, you don't even get in the car. You start it. It had keys. You have keys. You start the car. You drive off. I tried a third time. It didn't start. So I realized I wasn't going to get the car. So I seen her purse was in the seat. So I took the purse, left the scene, and as I was walking away, I heard her say, help me. I kept walking. I didn't help her. I didn't think about her. I didn't watch the news. I didn't read the newspaper. I didn't know if she lived. I didn't know if she died. I honestly didn't want to think about it. I just went on with my life. A week after the shooting, I had knee surgery. So now I'm home recovering from knee surgery. I've been home about a month. It's been a month after the shooting, so it's 3 weeks after surgery. I'm kind of going stir crazy. I'm at home. I need to get out of the house. I'm thirsty. Nothing in the refrigerator. I want a pop. So I figure, how much trouble can I get into if I go to the gas station to get a pop? First time out of the house since the shooting. And I get in my car. I had crutches. Get in the car to go get my pop. And unbeknownst to me, the first stoplight I come to right out of the apartment complex, I was face-to-face with the woman I'd shot a month earlier. I didn't know, but now I now know. She followed me, got my license plate number.
Did you know it was her at that moment?
No,
when you stopped?
I didn't see her. I just stopped at the light and went on. I didn't.
Did you know that she did? You didn't know her dad was behind you? And
no. I didn't think anything about it. I was just going to get a pop and went home. And that's mm-hmm. what I did. I went to get a pop and I went home. Next day, detectives come knocking on the door, asking me questions. I wasn't me. I didn't do it. You got the wrong person. You're wasting your time. You need to go find whoever did such a horrible thing. You need to go get them off the street. You know, if I hear anything, I'll let you know. And they didn't believe my lies. They took me to down to county jail and asked me some more questions. And they had enough evidence. Now they had an eyewitness and description of my car, license plate number. So they had enough to keep me. I pled not guilty, which went to a jury trial.
Why'd you plead not guilty?
Because I was in complete denial of doing anything wrong. I blocked it out of my head. I was trying to beat the case and go back to life and live like it never happened. So 9 months in the county jail, I go to trial. I get found guilty. 18 years old, I got sentenced to 20 years. 20 years is not enough time for the crime I had done, but 20 years was more years than I had been on earth. And I went behind the wall at the Indiana Reformatory, and I was still doing wrong. I mean, I tatted my body all up with devils and still getting high, still drinking, in prison, still doing wrong.
You were Pendleton at that point, yeah, right away?
Yeah. Went behind the wall, 18 years old. And I'd been there 3 years. 21st birthday, my mother said, "Keith, I want you to listen to the country radio station on your birthday. I got a song I'm going to dedicate to you." I said, "Mom, I don't want to listen to country. I listen to rap." she said, "Well, I want you to listen to this song." I said, "So, you know, it's Mom. I'm going to listen to my mom. Sometimes I listen." This time I put my headphones on in my cell. I'm sitting at 331J in the cell house at Pendleton, Indiana. And song came on the radio. The announcer, the DJ said, "This song goes out to Keith, who's in Pendleton. God loves you and your mama tried," and played a song by Merle Haggard called "Mama Tried." And I'd never heard that song before, and listening to the lyrics kind of made me tear up and start thinking about my life. And "No one could stir me right, mama tried, or pleading I denied. Poor old dad, rest his soul. He died, left my mom a heavy load. My dad died when I was 17. My mom couldn't handle my rebellious life."
That's not the song. That's your real life.
That was actually part of the song, but it was me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my application of it. I was like, wow. So, and then right at perfect timing, had a friend of mine lived in another cell around the corner, and he had one of the officers, one of the correctional officers. He said, "Go around, Mike." He said, "You know, my friend's turning 21. Go give him a hard time." So the officer comes to my cell. He don't know what I'm dealing with. He comes to the cell. He said, "Oh, man." He said, "You're 21 in prison. Don't you wish you could go to the bars?" I know what he meant, but I looked up through the bars. I said, "Sir, I am sick of bars." And that was my wake-up call. I didn't know what else to do. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Something needed to change. Life needs to get different. So when Evening Chow came that night, I went out and I talked to a guy down the range from me. He was about 30. I called him old school. It's amazing how old 30 seems when you're 21. But he was, I explained to him about the song, what was going on. He said, "Youngster," he said, "if you need the, you want to change, if you really want to change," he said, "you're going to need to change your nouns." I'm like, "Dude, look, I dropped out of school. I slept through English class."
Yeah.
I said, "Man, I don't even know what a noun is. You know what a noun is?"
Yeah.
"What's a noun?"
"Well, me, I."
Yeah, person, place, things.
Yeah.
He said, "Change the people you're with, the places you're going, and the things you're doing." I said, "Man, you lost your mind. I'm in this place. I'm with you people. We doing these things, and we were still doing criminal things, wrong things." He said, "Man, you're in a cell." He said, "Go to the dorm." Now, my first thought was, why would I want to do that? I've got my own cell, my own TV, own hot pot, fan, everything. Nobody's bothered me. I'm in my own space. Why would I want to go to a dormitory where I'm going to share space with other men?
Right.
He said, "Hey, you said you wanted to change." He said, "You go to that dorm, you'll be in a new place." I'm like, "Okay, new. There'll be new people there." I was like, "All right, people I don't know." He said, "Once you're in that new place with the new people," he said, "you can choose to do new things." I was like, "Man, that's crazy enough. That might work." So I put a request in. I go to the dorm. Now, I didn't know what was going to happen once I got there. I had my own bed. There was a locker, a foot locker, and then there was this table, and there was a chair. Now, the table I was supposed to share with my neighbor, but I noticed my neighbor wasn't sharing the table because he had all these books over. It was like a big old Bible, big old other books. I didn't know what it was. Later found out what they were. I determined he was a Christian because of the books that was on the table. Mm-hmm. So I figured, well, when he comes in from work, I'm going to, you know, confront him, tell him, hey, I need some space on my table. Well, he comes in, and we spent the next 3 months arguing about that book. He said, you know about that book? I said, yeah, I know the book. I've read the book. What, do you believe the book? Well, I believe the book's in my way. Can you move the book? We're going on, but I figured 3 months into it, you know, he told me about the gospel, told me about Jesus. I'd heard that growing up, but now it's becoming real. And I was like, man, so I realized that halfway up, now I'm not arguing with him no more. I'm arguing with God. And God didn't want no lies, and I had been lying. I'm still in prison saying I'm not guilty. I'm still trying to go on appeal. I'm still trying to come home. I'm not guilty. I said, Lord, I'm not. You're not who? You're not. Okay, so now I'm facing reality. I'm guilty. God already knew that. Now I got to tell my mom. How do you tell mom that you're guilty? It's going to break her heart. I wrote my mother a Mother's Day card in May of 96, and all I said was, Mom, I am guilty. I pulled the trigger at the phone booth. I shot the lady at still in her car. I'm in prison for what I did. I'm not innocent. I am guilty. You talk about freedom. I felt so light. I felt like I could have floated over that 40-foot wall. Free. Free to be truthful. Free to live. Free. Even in prison, I was freer than I'd ever been in my life. I wasn't in my addictions. I wasn't lying no more. I'm free. So I'm learning everything. You know, my mom, she wouldn't tell a lot of lies, but she always told one. She said, they'd asked her, they said, Lou, how's Keith doing? How's your son? She said, well, you know, Keith's fine. He's away at school. And I said, Mom, I'm not in school. I'm in prison. She said, you better learn something while you're there. Ah! So I learned. I got my GED. Enrolled at the feet of Jesus. Learned what I could do about church and Bible and going to church, getting in community. That was a big thing. Mm-hmm. And got into Ball State. They offered classes at the prison. Got my associate's degree. Was working towards my bachelor's. And my out date's fast approaching. I'm getting ready to get out of prison. It was 2001. I'm 27 years old, and I'm getting released. One semester away from having my bachelor degree, going back to a world I didn't know. I was incarcerated the whole Clinton administration. I got locked up. Bush was president. I came home to Bush being president. It was a different Bush. But so that whole time frame, the internet came out, computers came out, cell phones, Myers, Walmart, all these things was brand new. Life got real fast. Everything sped up. Mm-hmm. So I was playing catch up with life, but doing the next right thing. I get that I'm out. September 11th takes place. Mm-hmm. I got released in July of 2001. Mm-hmm. I was at Ball State attending classes when September 11th happened.
You were trying to finish that last semester.
Yeah, and trying to get my skill set back up. And September 11th happened. Mm-hmm. Had to process all that with the nation, everything that was going on. And I remember real well because September 12th, I had a restraining order hearing to go back to Indianapolis. So I came from Muncie to go to see my victim for the first time. Now, I've been a Christian, and I wanted to be able to say, Misty, I am sorry. How do you apologize for shooting somebody in the head and leaving them to die? I didn't know. But here was my one shot, my one opportunity. So I'm going. So I'm thinking the whole time, I'm not a threat to her. She don't know that. I'm not going to do anything to her. She don't know that. I'm thinking, man, as soon as this judge stops, I'm going to try to ease her mind. I'm going to say, Misty, I am sorry. That's the plan. Everything stopped. The judge.
Did you recognize her when you were in the hallway when you asked directions?
No. I didn't.
Maybe he could have. Yeah. Misty, I don't know.
Yeah. I asked, she was standing in the hallway. I didn't know what she looked like. I hadn't seen her since she was, you know, 18 years old in the courtroom, and we, you know, different. And I could not have picked her out of a lineup when the crime had happened. It was a random.
And you found your way to the courtroom.
So we went to the courtroom, and when we got in there, I looked around and I had her narrowed down to three possibilities. And then by the time we got to her last name, which was in the W's, the court had thinned out, and I knew, okay, that's her. And then at that time, I said, okay, that was the one I spoke to in the hallway. As soon as the judge stopped, I said, Your Honor, can I say something to, I didn't get her name out. I later found out it was her brother, but at that time I saw some man jumped up and was yelling at me. So everything got chaotic. Mm-hmm. The security came in, the bailiffs come in, they come in, they grabbed me, took me and my sister into this little room for my safety, for everybody's safety. And I was sitting on this chair in this little room, and this chair in this room felt smaller than any cell I'd ever been in. And I thought, man, my bullet, after all these years, my bullet that I put in my gun is still hurting my victim, still hurting Misty. Not only was it hurting Misty, it was hurting her brother. So I realized in that little room that when I shot Misty, I didn't just shoot Misty. I shot everybody that loved Misty. I shot her brother, her other brother, her sister, her mother, father, grandma. I shot her grandpa, the whole 1993 graduating class of Decatur High School. I shot them. In the process, even shot one of my own cousins that was good friends with her. To this day, we haven't spoke. Consequences of crime and more that I'd done.
To this day, you haven't spoken to that one cousin?
No. Ugh. I've seen him one time and we have not spoken. We was close growing up.
Sure.
He was my mom's sister's son. So,
shot yourself?
Yeah. I could say that. Everybody that everybody that loved all of us was impacted by that crime. So, I left thinking, man, okay, what do you do? So I just went on doing the next right thing, went on with life. Of course, I wasn't a threat to her. I stayed away. I got involved with nursing homes, jail ministries, juvenile. Mm-hmm. Felt a call into prison because I was ex-felon. I was having trouble getting back into prisons. Started in 2007, I actually started volunteering at Pendleton, same prison I did time at. I became a volunteer chaplain. They said later, hey, you want to become a chaplain? I had to go. I got my bachelor's from Ball State, graduated in 05.
Did you get it that semester after you got out of?
No, I had to withdraw. I was not ready for, I wasn't
ready for life.
Ready for everything going as fast as it was. But I did, 2005, I graduated at Ball State.
Okay.
Graduated on campus. That was exciting.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. And then now I got an opportunity to become a Department of Correction chaplain. They said I needed an MDiv. My first thing was an M what? So I looked up what an M, Masters of Divinity. I looked it up, found Indiana Wesleyan had a good program, and they were just starting their seminary. So 2009, I became in seminary and got hired with the Department of Correction. But while I was in class, I got a Facebook message from Misty. And I knew her name. Her name had been on a paper underneath my bunk for years. And here it was now on my computer screen, and my whole body is trembling. I'm like, okay. And I'm reading the words. I know you know who I am. Yes. I'm not angry. I'm not mad. Okay. And she said, I have chosen to forgive you. Wow. She said, but I have some questions. I sent her my number. For 45 minutes, I heard the story that you and your listeners are hearing today. I heard what my crime had done. I learned about the bullet staying in her body for 2 years. I learned about her losing consciousness out in California and the bullet moving, and they was able to remove it 2 years after the crime. I learned about the panic attacks and anxiety and depression. All the stuff that my bullet had did, I learned. Learned more about forgiveness. I don't know where people are, but my forgiveness has a face. And it's beautiful. I can look at it. We travel together. We speak together. We do things. We get to live this out. So, and forgiveness, you know, a lot of places we go and share this story and they're like, how do you really know you were forgiven? And we started early on doing talks, started in Indiana Wesleyan by a man named Jack Brady. And then he introduced us to a program called Bridges to Life. Which is a restorative justice program, which Misty now works full-time for. But we just learned about it in 2012, and we got invited to speak at Miami Correctional Facility to this program. And we went, and Bridges to Life was powerful, and we seen what it was doing, and it helped us get to a better place. And we became friends in the process. And we was sharing the story downtown Indy to a bunch of prosecutors, judges, correctional professionals, psychologists, doctors. Everybody was involved in corrections, whatever their role was. We had a breakout session called Forgiveness After Lunch, which is a difficult conference spot to have, but we have this spot reserved and had the room all set up nice and had the Kleenex and had the waters and the chairs. And Misty said, she said, Keith, are you going to be in this room for a minute? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, I need you to watch my purse for me. I'm going to go to bathroom.
Yes, I did.
I said, do you realize what you just asked me to do? She said, I didn't even think about it. This forgiveness is real. Mm-hmm. And that's been our experience and my experience. I didn't deserve to be forgiven, but Misty deserves to have peace. And what I found in this process, that forgiveness not only gives her peace, but it restores a peace to our lives and to community. And that's what Bridges to Life as a program attempts to do. And we're blessed to be involved in 7 facilities here in Indiana now. Many more in Texas where the program originated. But for Indiana, we have 7 prisons and growing. It's an awesome walk. Well, thank you for allowing us to be able to share. I'm sure you have some questions.
I'm moved very much by your story. You guys are really cool. I knew meeting on you on the phone and yeah, talking to you, Keith, on the phone, that this was going to be very special. How do you know, Keith, pointing to you, that you're recovered, that you'll never go back?
By the terminology and language in our understanding changes. For when I was in denial of my crime, everything was about me. It was the victim in my case. I'm doing my time, paying my debt to society. That leaves victims, that leaves Misty completely out of the thing. But when I was able to process and accept responsibility and tell not only God, but tell my mother, and then ultimately be able to tell Misty, to look Misty in the eye and say, I'm sorry. So now I become my victim. She's the one I hurt. She has a name. It's Misty. I now know her. So as we're sharing this, I now know what my crime had done. Mm. I can't put the bullet back inside of my gun, but I have that choice never to put a bullet back into a gun to do harm, because I know what crime does. It didn't just affect my victim, but it affects everybody that is involved in whatever form. Could have been somebody that worked with them. So part of my recovery is understanding how lives were impacted, what I've done, taking responsibility and being accountable for all. I'm accountable for her headaches. When we're driving in a car and she's having problems, her neck hurting, that's because of me. She has a headache. It was because of my crime all the way back in 92. So being able to look at that, and then now because I'm in ministry and in prison working with people, that's the same thing as well. That's also part of my, you know, part of my recovery and in helping others. So doing what we do, I'm definitely not going back to the way I used to be. I'm not that monster no more.
I can see it. It's just the first thing that I think my viewers would say, how do you know? And maybe that's a societal thing where we're just kind of scared, mm-hmm, and that recovery, right, and forgiveness. I mean, that's like, it's crazy to think, mm-hmm, but that's the way it is. And that's what you guys are showing. Misty, when was the moment that you forgave him? Like, was there a turn?
I had forgiven him. I've said it many times. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. But there was a moment that, I felt it, and that was during a talk at Miami Correctional Facility. We were sharing our story, just like we share today, with inmates. And during this story, we're sitting next to each other like we are now, and he looked me right in my eyes and said, I am truly sorry for everything that I've caused, the pain, the hurt that I've done, mm-hmm, to you. And that was the first time I actually felt the true, honest forgiveness. So that was my experience. I believe everybody will experience at a different level, you know, but that's when I first felt it. I had said it many times, but so I would say it was probably early off in our, we weren't even friends then.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
that, because it almost was. It obviously, yeah, forgiveness has, yeah, come before friendship. Yeah. Right. But you guys weren't friends at that point. But no, you were like, and forgiveness, it's a weird thing, because when you forgive somebody, it's funny because you also almost want good things for them.
Right.
And it's such a weird thing to think.
Yes.
This person did so much harm to me, yes, but yet I do want something good to happen.
Yes. Yes, it is. That's exactly how it is.
It's, yeah, mercy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is giving a benevolent gift that the offender does not deserve. Mm. So it is giving. It's forgiveness.
Yeah.
Or state of giving for a reason. And one thing we need to really, you know, say is forgiveness does not require friendship. No. It does not require relationships being reconciled.
That's a choice. Yes.
But forgiveness opens up that possibility if the people, so, you know, people can forgive. She could have forgave me and never spoke to me again, and I wouldn't have been any less forgiven.
Right.
She chose to walk alongside and do what I was already doing.
Yeah.
And when we invited her into prison to speak, her first thing was,
I'm not going into prison. Absolutely no.
I told Jack Brady, I said, she's not going to go. He said, do you think I should ask her? I'm like, no, she's not going. And then about 2 weeks later, she called Jack and said,
I'll go to the university first, but after that, we'll try the prison. Let me do the university first, yeah, and then I'll go to prison.
Yeah, of course.
And
I found that being in prison and sharing my story was no different than sharing my story in a church setting, because they're human too. Yep. You know, just made bad choices.
What do you think your most memorable reaction to your story has been?
Probably last week.
Yeah. Really? Last week at IWP, and then you at my prison. Yeah, because he's a chaplain there.
Sure.
So he works there every day with those women. And for me to get up and to share my story, and there wasn't a dry eye in the room, and it was just very powerful, because they're like, this is our chaplain, and then he shot and almost killed her. And so these girls are like, these inmates.
Yeah, and they're standing there watching you.
Yeah, we got like,
When she said, I'm going to introduce my shooter and it's your chaplain, you heard everything from gasp to, holy crap.
Yes, yes.
That's the goal.
Very vocal.
That's very the goal. Good.
Yeah.
You want that. I mean, I'm sure you were pretty proud, too, to be able to walk up, because it's funny. Here's my shooter and I'm proud to introduce him.
Right. Well, I usually say, here's my shooter, who is now also my friend, and that's a lot for any individual to take in at one time, because they've heard my story and they've heard the hurt and the pain and the trauma to certain levels of,
which is understandable. Yes. I mean, I think everybody can relate.
Yes. And then I'm calling him up, which they have no idea if he's here. And then when he comes up, I'm also saying who is now my friend.
So, yeah, we tried to do that to our listeners here today a little bit. But it's funny, because my questions are more just how that friendship grew. What was the first moment that you guys were friends?
We got invited to New York to be on the Katie Couric show after Karen Hensel did a report on us from Channel 8.
Oh, that Channel 8.
Yes. Yeah.
We know that Wish TV well here.
Yes. That was Karen Hensel's work on that really helped us,
because
she was she's a great reporter. Was very patient, let us tell her story, and Katie Couric's people got a hold of it, and we got invited to New York, and they called us on a Thursday, called me, said, we need you in New York on Monday. Can you come? I'm like, and Misty needs to come. And I'm like, oh, we got lives, we got jobs. I got to ask my wife. She's got to ask her husband. We got to ask. I mean, we've never been, up to this point, we've never been alone anywhere. We always had either Jack with us or Dave from the Department of Corrections, but somebody was always with us. We was never alone. And going to New York, they had two tickets. You leaving at this time, go. I'd never even been on an airplane. And now we land in.
Why are you laughing at him?
Because she tortured me. She tortured me.
On the plane?
I did.
I had never been on an airplane, and she was late.
Oh, God.
So I'm in the plane, sitting in the seat that I barely was fitting in, because the seats aren't that big. Mm. And, you know, I'm kind of bigger. And she comes in, and the first thing she says to me is, if we go down, that seatbelt's not going to save you.
You're so mean, Misty.
Well, good, because the seatbelt don't even fit me. You know, I had to wait for the lady that was explaining how to use the seatbelt to give me the extender that she was in. So I put the extender on it, and we go, and every time we hit turbulence, she says, what was that? So
it's only an hour and a half.
I got sick. So
oh, you did. Oh,
I was fine. I love
see,
it.
Yeah, see,
that was my
you got payback.
I did.
And then Katie Kirk and you guys were on with yes. with her and. Yes.
And yes. then she awesome. Asked us on the show. She said, "Are you friends?" Now we'd talked for a year and had now been starting. So we're going in our second year of communication, and we was. Now with each other face to face, but we wasn't really wouldn't call ourselves friends. And Katie Couric said, "Are you friends?" And I said, "We're not even friends on Facebook because at that time we was just messaging. We wasn't friends.
Right.
It was just through Messenger." On the airplane, Misty sent me a friend request. So when I landed back in Indianapolis, I accepted her. So we became Facebook friends. Then we became a friend. So,
yeah,
Facebook friends before real friends.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
Golly, how much does faith play a role? I mean, we've talked about God.
Yes,
Keith, you've really mentioned your change, but Misty, you haven't as much.
Right, because faith wasn't as big in my life at that time. Now I was praying underneath the will. I believe in God. I went to church on Sundays with my aunt. Wasn't really a family that went to church. But I believe in God. And so my to play in my role was the wow factor after I was saved and baptized of seeing God's hand holding me all the way through.
The no starter, the fact that the car didn't start, the fact that that man took a left instead of a right and saw your body laying there. Oh, and by the way, Tim's a veteran, essentially someone who could take care of take care of you.
And a cross-trained pastor in a church.
Yep. And wow.
And he stayed with me, and he came to the hospital. He called my parents, and he came. He didn't want to come without asking if it was proper, and he went back to his church and had his church praying for me. And
I mean that, and then when you were going through your panic attacks in San Diego, how many years ago after the crime did it happen?
See, 95 years.
2 years. And two. How long did it take you to go in prison and switch your lifestyle?
3 years.
3 years. I was wondering if it was the same. It'd be a really cool coincidence.
Yeah, and with her father, I got to spend 2 weeks in Florida with her father. The whole drive to Florida, because we're driving. I'm driving the car.
Oh, you mean
driving.
This is after you guys are friends? And
We're going down to Florida to meet her dad, and we had a prison to speak in a couple churches, and. She's excited. She's going to see her dad.
I'm
thinking, what do you say to this man who you shot his daughter? The same one you said was in that parking lot that very easily could have took care of me at that moment without police being involved. And I got down and I'm thinking, what am I going to say to him? So when we pull up to his house, reminded me of going into a prison. He has this big gate, and he had. She says he had mail in his hand. I thought he had a clipboard. I was trying to make sure he was going to get into the compound. Well, we get in there, and the first thing she hugs him, and then I put my hand out. I said, "Sir, I just want to say I'm sorry for the pain and hurt I caused your family, and I want you to know your daughter is one of the strongest, most amazing women I've ever met." And he said, "She's phenomenal, ain't she?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You want coffee?" I said, "Yes, sir." And we went in, it was 11 o'clock at night, we sit down over coffee, and he said, his first words when he put down his coffee, he said, "I wanted you dead. I looked for you to make that happen." He said, "In 1997, the Lord ironed all that out." And then I was thinking that was, I was 96 was my conversion. So God was dealing with hearts all the way, all around the thing. And I was like, wow, this is it's powerful. Forgiveness is powerful.
Why are you crying, Misty? I haven't seen you cry yet.
It's not a bad thing. It's just.
Of course.
Release sometimes.
I'm sure your father's words resonate now.
Very much.
Well, you guys are really strong. I'm just psyched to meet you. This is one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life. And I've been a reporter for 10 years, and I can tell why that reporter at Channel 8 did a good job, because it's one hell of a story. You better not mess it up. So
yeah, she begged him for extra time. I think she came out with 5 minutes and 7 seconds off a 3-minute story.
Doesn't matter. It can run a damn special on it. I wanted, before we go, I have a couple more questions. So for my viewers, this is an interview. I don't really care how long it takes. This is something that my viewers, you can pause it and listen to it later.
Right.
Listeners, I should say, not viewers. I'm still in TV mode. I want to ask, more importantly, both of your opinions, you can go one at a time, whatever, about the way crime affects communities and the ripple effect it has on a community and a generation. Sometimes it can have my last episode that I just released was Jim Jones.
Right.
That guy murder-suicided 900 people. And that is still in effect. I talked to his son about this same thing. Yeah. You guys have a different perspective. We're talking more minuscule, but the crime maybe, when you do it out, it could be the same amount.
Yes. Yeah.
So, what is your opinion on the?
I think it affects the community very much. So I think that not only is it's not just the victim and an offender. It's the victim, offender, and their families.
Mm.
Everyone from one crime, it could ricochet through a whole entire generation of people.
Mm. Is there something that's misunderstood about crime that when we think about it or when we listen to it or when we learn about it, is there something that's misunderstood?
I think with our work with Bridges to Life has really opened my eyes up. We went early on in our talks, we got invited to Toledo, Ohio, to speak at Toledo University, and we were speaking to a restorative justice group. I had never heard the term restorative justice. At the end of our talk, we shared it just like we did with you and your listeners, no different. One of the professors stood up and applauded, and then everybody else rose up and applauded. And when everybody stopped clapping, the professor in the front said, "You two are the epitome of our field." Now, I didn't even know how to spell epitome. Wasn't sure I'd heard it before. I looked up what epitome or and the top, the goal, the standard of our field. I was like, okay, so we're the standard of a field I'd never heard of. So I went and got some books. I went and found restorative justice books, started reading, self-study, started looking at restorative justice. And Bridges to Life, I knew, was a restorative justice program. So we're trying to put all this together. And under the system that we have now, is basically a criminal justice system, is punitive. It asks, who done the crime? Well, what was the crime? Let's say this one, attempted murder. Who done the crime? Keith Blackburn. What does he deserve? 20 years in prison. Victims are left completely out of that. Mm-hmm. 20, that's it, 20 years, and he's going to get out in 8 years and 8 months. That's not even 20. That's not enough time. He needs to be punished for his crime, and that is accurate. But going to prison is not punishment, but it's a part where we should be restored back to ultimately society. So restorative justice asks the same questions, but kind of in a different way. What was the crime? Attempted murder. Who committed the crime? Keith Blackburn, who was impacted? Okay. Misty, her family, mom, dad, uncle, everybody that loved her, my mom, sister, everybody that loved me, our neighborhoods, our community. Yeah.
Tim, who found Misty.
Tim Williams is the detective.
Yeah.
We're actually on schedule, I believe, to go out.
The nurses.
Nurses, doctors.
The doctors who took care of you and your PTSD.
And people, like with her detective, I lied to him. He's a homicide detective. He's seen the worst of the worst all the time. And that's all he saw, all he sees. So what we know, what society needs? Society needs restored, needs a sense of peace, and needs to be safe. So restorative justice don't take away the fact they need to be safe. safety and security. I mean, I work in the Indiana Department of Corrections. Safety and security is number one on our list of what we do first. Safety, security, then we bring programming and do things. So with restorative justice, we restore, but we make it safe. So I think, you know, can people change? Yes. Are there some people that need to be in prison for the rest of their lives? Yes. I know a few that they're fine where they are.
Yeah.
There's been no change, but once you go through a process and you ask me, you know, how do you know when you're changed? And they always ask me, he's like, well, what do you know when somebody's ready to get out? Listen to their language. When it goes from changes from I, me to service type language, I'm going to get out, I'm going to help, I'm going to do, and what they can do with their community.
And you don't need to be an offender who wants to change their ways to change your language like that. There are people that struggle with addiction,
yes,
with real life stuff in every day that maybe aren't offenders.
Right.
That's a real lesson I think everybody can learn from, not just people who are committed a crime,
right,
or want to forgive or forget.
A casual reading of Facebook comments can do it. When we first started this, Misty and I made an agreement that we would not respond to any negative
feedback.
It's been difficult because somebody has said something. Like after the Katie Couric interview, I mean, they attacked everything from my looks to my weight to saying, well, she's doing it, to attacking both
I'm
of us
mentally
on,
ill.
On, yeah. on that. I'm like, but we determined we wasn't going to respond. So it's worked well for us.
Are you mentally ill for being friends with Keith?
Absolutely not. Actually, I'm mentally relieved because my forgiveness has given me a peace of mind that I never had before.
And don't you hit a different plane?
You do.
After you've gone through the lowest of your low,
yes,
and now you're at your high, or right, no, I shouldn't say high, you're right, at a different place. You're in a different place, and it's difficult to be around people that aren't in the same place as you anymore, which is good for offenders in the sense they're not going back into a place where they made this life for themselves.
Right.
But like even for you, Misty, it's like all of a sudden the people that you're like once looked at is it just everything looks different now,
right?
And you see things differently. Right. So, well, I don't know, guys. This is
amazing.
You're amazing.
Yeah,
really appreciate it. I'm set unless you guys want to say something else. Yeah. Thanks for coming to my house.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite.
Yes,
enjoyed
thank
it.
You.
My wife. She will be very happy.
We will
happy.
Not tell her we were upstairs. Okay, turn the mic off.
No, we're not turning it off yet. It's not off yet.
We're not going to tell her we were upstairs in the kids' room.
And there's games everywhere.
There's games everywhere. And we're playing Nintendo right now.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming. I'm truly moved, and I hope my viewers are too. Where can people go to learn more?
Get in contact with me through Bridges to Life. You can visit it at misty@bridgestolife.org. And just go online and get in contact.
Email
with
you.
Me, email me.
Misty@bridgestolife.org.
We go to bridgestolife.org. www.bridgestolife.org is the website for Bridges to Life. And if any of your listeners want to get involved with a restorative justice program, we're always needing volunteers.
Yes.
And we're
especially here in Indiana.
We want to be in all. We're in 7 prisons, and we want to be in all of our prisons
in Indiana.
So we need volunteers.
I think, Misty, you're going to set me up with someone else who.
I have quite a few.
We have a few. So here's the deal, listeners of Infamous Indy. When I have a story that Misty brings me, I'll make sure to give you all the info that you need. But I'm going to mention it on the podcast, so you'll know based on the episode, if Misty's helping me, because I'd like to create a partnership as well to make sure that your stories get out there and that your restorative justice movement gets out there as much as possible.
Absolutely.
I don't know how many people are listening to this, but hey, why not? At least you get another round of media.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both again. Golly, I hope you guys take a lesson from this, everybody who's listening, to the power of forgiveness and the power of God
And we don't talk a lot about Jesus and God on this podcast. It's not necessarily something that comes up, but when it is come up, we don't shy away from it. So I think you guys are more of a testimony of that than anything else that I've done. So
thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kind of left a veil of mystery before that episode in that intro, and that's for a reason. As you can tell, what an unbelievable pair to come and be able to tell their story on a regular basis. They do that on a regular basis, but to share it with them via this platform and Infamous Indie, what an honor. And just, it really excites me, because that's what my podcast is about. That is what I want it to be. Some way to introspectively look at how things can get better. And forgiveness is real. And that's what these two proved to me. And I hope it proved that to you. We're going to continue to go on. And next couple of weeks, you know, we got a new podcast. We're trying to come out with a second half of this podcast with my wife. We're still kind of working out the details, but once we get it down, we're going to bring it to you as soon as we can. But it's not something I really want to rush. We want to make sure it's done properly, and it's something we both really want to talk about. So with that said, as I always say at the end of every episode, stay safe.